Case number 071162, Albany Engineering Corporation petitioner versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Mr. Wong for the petitioner, Ms. Perry for the respondent, Mr. McCartney for the intervener.
Thank you, Judge Brown. The deputy clerk has suggested that I inform you that I've asked to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court, my name is William Wong, and I represent Albany Engineering Corporation. This case turns on whether the federal system of charges for headwater benefits under the Federal Power Act preempts the regulating district's system of charges for headwater benefits imposed under state law. Since First Iowa Electric Co-op versus FPC, the courts have recognized broad preemption in the area of hydropower regulation. Notwithstanding this precedent, FERC in this case erroneously ruled that FERC under federal law and the regulating district under state law both may impose charges on Albany Engineering for the same headwater benefits, the benefits it receives from the upstream reservoir owned by the regulating district. At the outset, it's important to recognize that the charges at issue, the regulating district charges at issue, are headwater benefits charges. FERC ruled that was the case in 2002 and 2003 when it first issued an order issuing a license to the district. The district did not seek review of that ruling. FERC reiterated the same conclusion in its orders in this case. In the December 2006 order on complaint, the commission held that there is no question that the district's assessments are assessments for headwater benefits. It affirmed that ruling in its order on rehearing in May 2007, at that time rejecting a new challenge against that finding that had been raised by the district. So for purposes of evaluating the FERC decision in this case, the law of the case is that the regulating district's charges are charges for headwater benefits.
Before we evaluate FERC's decision here, I have a threshold question, which is whether this court has to defer to FERC's preemption determination.
I'm sorry, that last part of your...
Whether this court is required to defer to FERC's preemption determination.
Under the Chevron tests, the court is not required to defer to FERC's decision because the statute at issue is clear. It's unambiguous that FERC is the entity that is supposed to set the charges and directed to set the equitable charges for headwater benefits. In addition, congressional intent from the legislative history indicates that it was not the intent of Congress to allow additional state-based charges to be charged to downstream licensees on top of the federally mandated charges. Even if we were to move to Chevron Step 2, which we think is not necessary in this case, FERC's interpretation of the Federal Power Act is unreasonable. It essentially, notwithstanding the fact there is a single set of headwater benefits at issue, has two separate entities deciding how much Albany Engineering should be required to pay for that one thing.
The statute doesn't refer to operating costs at all, right?
It doesn't, and it doesn't for a reason, because Congress reached a balance between upstream licensees and downstream licensees in determining how to allocate the costs and benefits of being on the same river. And Congress decided that the appropriate balance to reach was to restrict headwater benefits charges to the upstream project owners' interest, depreciation, and maintenance charges, and in fact only the equitable share of those charges.
Would have been pretty easy for Congress to say that in the actual text of the statute if that's what it intended.
Congress When it subsequently, there were actually efforts to modify the statute later to add additional charges, and Congress actually rejected those efforts.
But the Supreme Court has repeatedly said, and we have as well, that relying on subsequent failed legislative proposals is a treacherous ground on which to interpret a prior statute, and I think that's applicable here.
I understand that, but there's also in Brown and Williamson Tobacco Company, the court in that case did expressly consider the FDA's, the Congress's consideration of amendment to add tobacco to the list of regulated substances.
They're free to disregard their general principles.
I'm sorry?
They're free to disregard their general principles.
And in this case, in fact, all of the legislative history and information on the intent of Congress actually favors Albany Engineering's interpretation of this statute. FERC has not come forward with any
statement anywhere in the legislative history that says states should not be able to impose any charges for operating costs.
There were efforts in the 1950s and 1960s to expressly allow states to have systems of state-based headwater benefits charges, and Congress rejected them.
So is the answer no?
The answer is no. That's correct. There's nothing expressed in the early legislative history, in the later legislative history.
I didn't see anything in the briefs on exactly how one might draw the line between maintenance and operational costs. I mean, my initial reaction was that probably there would, in the nature of things, be huge overlap. And that was somewhat vindicated by Representative Esch's remark as he introduces the bill, talking as if it encompassed operational costs.
I think that at the time that the bill was discussed, there is some ambiguity as to what exactly is encompassed within the costs. The commission has consistently held that Section 10F covers maintenance, interest appreciation and maintenance costs, and does not include operations costs.
Is it easy to draw that line?
The Uniform System of Accounts does provide for a distinction between maintenance and operations costs, the FERC Uniform System of Accounts, so that there is a methodology that FERC has adopted in order to draw a line between maintenance and operations.
Without dispute. It's applied without serious dispute.
I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that question. I think that in focusing on the specific costs that are covered, one of the major points is being missed, though, which is that what Section 10F is about is headwater benefits, and that the federal system of headwater benefits charges actually focuses on those benefits, not simply cost categories that are associated with the upstream project. Even before FERC succeeded the Federal Power Commission, headwater benefits under federal law were always capped at the value of the benefits that were actually realized by the downstream project owner. Under current FERC regulations, the cap on headwater benefits charges is even lower. It's 85% of the value of the benefits that are actually realized by the downstream project owner. FERC policy requires that at least 15% of the value of the downstream headwater benefits actually stays with the downstream project owner. And FERC passed that rule in 1986 because it realized that if 100% of the financial benefits of the headwater benefits were actually transferred to the upstream project owner, then the downstream project owner would have really no incentive to run down its equipment or to make any modifications to its project to take advantage of changes in flows as a result of the upstream project. So really, FERC's rules establish a system that accounts for expressly 100% of the total benefits that are realized by the downstream project owner. There is really no room in the system for additional charges on top of those federal charges from the regulating district. To the extent that the regulating district imposes charges on top of the amount that's approved under federal law, it's second-guessing the determination that's been made by the federal government as to the appropriate headwater benefits charges. And if the regulating district charges result in exceeding the 85% cap that exists in FERC's regulations, then it's in direct violation or direct conflict with the federal determination that at least a share of the financial benefits of headwater benefits should remain with the downstream project owner. The regulating district's charges are in direct conflict with FERC's regulations and the overall system created by the federal government to address headwater benefits. In addition to the basic conflict between the district's charges and the general structure of the federal regulatory scheme, FERC's interpretation of Section 10F allows a combination of federal and state charges that actually exceeds the value of the benefits realized by the downstream project owner. FERC has never provided a coherent explanation that addresses this fundamental problem and how it can be reconciled with the federal system, which limits headwater benefits charges to actual benefits realized by the downstream project owner. The closest it's come is a statement in its brief that there is no doubt that these differences exist on page 26 of its brief, followed by an assertion, but without any explanation, that this somehow does not produce a conflict. Maybe FERC will have an explanation today. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. I'd just like to wrap up.
A question about the remedy. Let's assume that Section 309 would provide FERC authority to provide a remedy in these circumstances. Is there anything in the language or structure of the Act that compels it to give a remedy?
We believe that Section 10F requires FERC to set the equitable charges.
I know 10F, but I'm turning
right,
to 309.
And that is actually the hook for Section 309 of the Federal Power Act, which does require that there be some obligation or power or duty in the other portions of the Federal Power Act to allow them to exercise the authority they have under Section 309.
What if licensee A does something aggressive and burdensome to licensee B, which is really your characterization of what's happening here? Does FERC have an obligation to step into that and tell the aggressor licensee to back off?
We believe that it does, that FERC has jurisdiction over the licensee so long as the subject matter is really involving the project and the licenses that they hold. Here, the subject is headwater benefits charges, which are specifically covered in Section 10F of the Federal Power Act, and that's squarely within the Commission's jurisdiction. In fact, FERC has already directed the regulating district to file its headwater benefits charges with FERC before issuing them. The district has not done so, but FERC has actually already exercised that authority in 2003. I'd like to save my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Lina Perry for the Commission. I'd like to begin with the first question that was asked to the petitioner, which is whether or not the Commission is entitled to deference for its statutory interpretation in this case. And I would say that certainly it is, because the particular part of the statute in 10F that the Commission was construing is entirely ambiguous as to expenses other than those that are enumerated in the statute.
Ambiguity in the word deference. Do you mean Chevron applies, or you're simply saying the Commission wins? They're quite separate inquiries.
It's Chevron step two, Your Honor. The statute
maybe you want to cover Chevron step one first.
Well, Chevron step one, Your Honor, would apply with respect to what the commission is required to do under Section 10F, which in what the commission is required to do under Section 10F is really quite clear and quite limited. It's to make charges for interest, depreciation, and maintenance in an equitable amount to licensees who are benefited by a headwind. And no more, Your Honor. And so we're
on the commission's theory, Congress explicitly limited the federal body looking at all licensees along a waterway and said not a penny over interest, maintenance, and depreciation, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
But so far as the states were concerned, Congress didn't care. Is that the proposition you're asking us to accept?
The proposition, Your Honor, is that as to anything other than entrance, maintenance, and depreciation, Congress did not specify one way or the other what was to happen.
Well, it didn't specify directly, but I guess just in trying to get a coherent reading of this statute, why would Congress say this far but no farther for the commission? States, be our guest.
Well, with
do what you like to, no matter how much it may upset the scheme.
But that's exactly the point, Your Honor. I mean, the commission went through the entire analysis of does allowing the state to assess these charges in any way interfere with the federal scheme? And that, in particular, if you look...
And could you answer that question by defining the federal scheme entirely in terms of the goal of providing money for the upstream licensee, right?
Entirely.
In other words, you don't see it as in any respect a balance between the interests of the downstream licensee and the upstream licensee, not in any respect.
Your Honor, it is a balance in the sense that the commission assigns an equitable portion of the interest, maintenance, and appreciation.
It's also a balance in that the commission is limited to interest, maintenance, and depreciation, is it not?
No, Your Honor, not necessarily. Because the Congress didn't speak to that at all. And in looking at the legislative history...
Just a second. We did agree, I thought, that Congress did speak to the issue of charges imposed by the commission that are not based on entrance, maintenance, and depreciation, right? We agreed on that.
That's right, Your Honor.
So you're saying Congress is absolutely settled on that as far as the federal scheme was concerned.
That's right, Your Honor.
But everybody else, the sky's the limit. Does that make a particle of sense?
Certainly it does, Your Honor, because the commission went back and looked at the legislative history and at the statutory language and determined that the only evidence of congressional intent had to do with the intent to encourage construction of storage reservoirs and equalize competitive conditions so that the upstream people were not disadvantaged by the expense of the storage reservoir.
There must be 10 Supreme Court decisions that chide everyone involved to look beyond sort of the initial statement of the impetus for a statute. And they recognize that every statute represents some kind of balance between the initial impetus and restraining characteristics, factors. And what you do is you look at the initial impetus and you stop. But the language precludes that. The language specifies three things to be covered and presumably it means something with that. And you acknowledge it means something as far as your powers are concerned.
Yes, Your Honor, but what the commission was looking at, it went through all of the considerations for preemption to determine whether or not it should decide that this particular statutory language, in fact, did have preemptive effect as to the state charges. And in particular, if you look at your joint appendix at page 11, paragraphs 49 and 50 of the complaint order, they went through all of the, there's no express preemption in the statute. We've already covered that. It's not a comprehensive provision in the sense that it doesn't say the federal government will charge these three expenses and no other expenses will be charged.
That would be expressed.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You have acknowledged that that is the case, even though it is not explicitly stated.
I mean, I'm sorry, as to the federal government, but the statute doesn't say no other expenses will be charged by any other entity. The states will
be
precluded from...
That would be express preemption, and we wouldn't have the need to go through this kind of analysis, but the Supreme Court always goes through this kind of analysis, as Judge Williams noted.
Yes, Your Honor, but with respect to a comprehensive provision, for example, if you consider the kind of licensing provisions that were at issue in First Iowa or that sort of thing, those are comprehensive provisions that basically say everything that has to do with licensing the project is the business of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
The statute, however, did not say explicitly that states are totally out of the picture. It did not say that.
It did give, though, authority to the commission for the entire licensing process. And the commission's problem in this case,
for headwater benefits covering interest, maintenance, and depreciation, period, full stop.
That's right, Your Honor. It was a very limited grant of authority, and therefore the commission felt that it had not been expressly or even by the nature of the provision been granted any other authority with respect to other expenses.
Why do you suppose it was limited?
It was limited, Your Honor, because, and this is why the commission focused on the emphasis on construction, it was limited to essentially construction costs in the commission's mind. What the federal government was interested in doing.
What would we infer from that about what people in Congress voting on the matter would have thought was a suitable allocation of the costs?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I mean, I believe that they regarded interest, maintenance, and depreciation as being the appropriate construction costs to be used as I said before, the incentive to...
The appropriate costs, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right? The appropriate costs.
Because they were interested...
Is that the end of it?
Because they were interested in reimbursing the upstream storage reservoir for construction costs.
And in finding a correct balance between the upstream and the downstream licensees, right?
In the sense that they permitted the commission to make a determination about what is an equitable portion of the entrance maintenance and depreciation.
That's not the only respect in which it was looking at a balance, right? The other respect in which it was looking at a balance was in defining the reimbursable costs.
But, Your Honor, the commission recognized that that is one way that you could interpret the statute, but the statute does not require that interpretation, was the point. And looking at the purpose of the statute and the disruption that would be caused by entirely preempting the state program.
What's the disruption?
Because
this system apparently has prevailed successfully for whatever it is, 70 years, without a problem.
Well, right, Your Honor, what you're talking about, if you accepted Albany Engineering's position, is throwing out the assessment provisions entirely for the district reservoir. They're entirely preempted by 10F, and they are only allowed to charge whatever the commission will allow them to charge for interest, maintenance, and depreciation.
Right.
So you're entirely undermining their long-standing, as you say, program for financing their state-run reservoir and charging the benefits to the downstream beneficiaries of that. So preemption in this case had drastic consequences as far as the district is concerned, because that's their only means of financing their operations. So that was one of the things that the commission was considering. It was trying to honor the federal preemption insofar as it was necessary, but no further than necessary, and to allow the state program to remain in place as much as possible. And that was the balance that the commission was trying to reach in interpreting the statute, so as to no more than necessary disrupt the state program, which had been operating for quite some time. And
how do other upstream licensees get along not having the state come in on your side creates a terrible problem for financing?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, this is actually a very unique situation.
We're trying to interpret the statute for all purposes. Let's say for all purposes regarding headwater benefits charges other than interest, maintenance, and depreciation.
Right, Your Honor, but this is... Upstream licensees, the storage reservoirs and whatnot, are generally privately owned. I mean, this is a very unusual...
They get along without this ability to extract money from downstream licensees.
That's right, Your Honor. The private owned storage reservoirs don't have the ability as a state agency to assess the downstream licensees' additional charges.
Well, when FERC licenses a new project, let's say, does FERC look at whether it's economic or uneconomic? In other words, whether the services that they're going to provide can cover their operating costs? Because presumably they can't assess other headwater charges, correct?
Right, Your Honor, but that goes back to the purpose of the statute, in part, was to provide at least some reimbursement to the people who constructed the upstream reservoirs that were benefiting the downstream licensees, to provide them at least some credit towards their construction costs, right, because otherwise they would have none.
Well, right, so, but that's all that Congress provided, this, interest, depreciation, and maintenance going toward their construction costs. So if you're a private upstream project, that's all you get, and your operating cost has to be covered however you recover it.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay. So why would it be different for a state entity?
It's different for a state entity, Your Honor, simply because the commission, in looking at the statute, saw no prohibition on states being able to have a separate program by which they assess charges against the downstream licensees.
Well, that's probably, I assume that if you had a private licensee, there's no prohibition on getting the money some other way. It just can't be a headwater benefits charge, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, but there's no state authority behind that, though. I mean, the thing that made this unique was
that... On your view, there's nothing to prevent the state from adopting such a law, right?
I don't know that there is, Your Honor. That was not the situation that was presented to the commission. Well,
that's the theory that you're arguing, and that would be the implications of a decision.
Well, it's possible that that's true, but...
States could enact new laws transferring money from downstream to upstream, even in a private situation.
The commission would have to address that. I mean, that was not specifically addressed in these orders, Your Honor. They were looking at the facts presented.
As a principal distinction?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What could it identify as a principal distinction?
I don't know, Your Honor. It depends on what the state statute says. It depends on what kind of authority is given to the upstream reservoir. It depends on who's being charged and what they're being charged for. I mean, there are a lot of factors that would go into whether or not it would fall under the same analysis or not. I just really don't know how to predict that. So I don't know how to tell you what the commission would say about that, because I don't know how – I'm not aware that that exists at the time.
Question, you can't identify a principled distinction between the state case and the private case.
There may be one.
Saying there might be something out there.
There might be one. I mean, it just depends on the circumstances of the individual statute at issue and the powers granted and who's being charged, and all of those factors go into the preemption analysis. I would like to point out one thing about the when you were asking about the difference between maintenance and operation costs, just for your information, the Joint Appendix on page 24 at paragraph 29 in the rehearing order, the commission does make the point that the petitioner was making, actually, that they're in the uniform system of accounts, maintenance costs and operation costs do have distinct and separate meanings and are separable categories. I see my time's up. If there are no further questions?
I did have one other question.
Oh, sure.
There's something about this decision that seems to me a little bit peculiar, and that is that FERC seems to say that we find preemption here. We think it's okay, not inconsistent, but even if we found that they were doing something that was completely preempted, we would have no authority to remedy that problem.
What the commission, you have to, the one thing to bear in mind here is what the commission was responding to was the Albany Engineering complaint, the request for relief in the complaint. And what Albany Engineering had said in their complaint was 10F entirely preempts any assessments the district can make. So what we want you to do, Commission, and you can see this, the remedy section is at pages 59 through 61 of their of the joint appendix. And they said, what we want you to do, Commission, is we want you to make them rescind all of the assessments, we want you to make them refund them, and we want you to keep them from being able to charge any assessments in the future.
I understand the Commission might have been saying, we can't do those specific things, but as I read their decision, it seemed that they were saying, even if it were worse than this, even if we were convinced it was inconsistent, there would be nothing that we could do. Even though, as I think, the district is now a licensee of the commission, correct?
That's right, Your Honor. It is a licensee. But the point was is that, well, in the first place, it couldn't do, because of its preemption analysis, it had no authority to make the district rescind all of its assessments or any of that. But in this,
that maybe suggests that they shouldn't have been doing the preemption analysis?
I don't know. I don't really see why, Your Honor. They were trying to limit federal encroachment to, as much as possible, to what was expressly stated in the statute and to allow the state to continue to operate insofar as possible outside of that. But the other thing is, on the issue of it was the combination of the commission had no jurisdiction over the entirety of the district's assessments and all of that that was conducted under state law. Couldn't make them refund them or anything. And they have a full and adequate remedy under state law, by the way. The New York Court of Appeals has held with respect to this district that there can be cases brought against assessments challenging arbitrary and capriciousness, equal protection, any of those claims. They have a remedy, it's just not before the commission. And the other problem with the remedy the commission had here was no one was requesting a headwater benefits determination. At page 59 of their joint appendix, page 59, the fourth branch in their complaint said expressly, we are not asking for a headwaters benefits investigation. And the commission's point was, absent that, we have no basis to make any determination about anything. And because in these circumstances, we don't do it until we're requested to do so, we have no basis for making any kind of a remedial decision.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Michael McCarty, appearing on behalf of the regulating district. I did want to address one of the questions that arose from Judge Williams. With respect to, is the sky the limit? I don't think this court needs to engage in speculation about what might happen down the line if state legislatures were to pass some laws trying to cross-subsidize the operation of an upstream reservoir by overcharging downstream beneficiaries. In the however many years since 1920, when the Federal Power Act was passed, to my knowledge, there are only three state chartered entities out there that were created for the express purpose of building storage reservoirs in the headwaters of a river basin that provide substantial benefits to hydroelectric projects downstream and which recover all of their costs through that system. The commission back in the 1960s, I believe, did approve arrangements between a state chartered corporation that happened to be owned by all of the hydroelectric projects downstream of it for paying those corporations entire expenses. They did approve that as a headwater benefits settlement. Since that time,
that's a purely private contract.
It was a private agreement among related corporations, but it was somehow a state chartered corporation which specified in that law how the upstream corporation was to recover its costs. This was the Chippewa and Flambeau Improvement Company and the Wisconsin River Improvement Company out in the state of Wisconsin, Your Honor. Addressing another question about drawing the line between maintenance and operation costs, that is a real problem for the regulating district because right now it doesn't keep its books of account in accordance with FERC's Uniform System of Account. We were only dragged into being a licensee in 2002 by a peculiarity of law which forbade us from conveying an easement interest to the downstream licensee, which is the way you usually get the type of interest that FERC requires in the proprietary interest that FERC requires in a dam and reservoir for a downstream license. As you know, the regulating district doesn't own any power facilities. But in 1959, Congress passed a law for the express purpose of encouraging the construction of storage reservoirs by state and municipal entities, which exempted them from keeping their books in accordance with the Uniform System of Accounts. Now, we did not address this in our brief. I didn't even know about it till I was preparing for argument here. And if you're interested, I can supply you the citation to that. But municipal entities, state entities, are not required to keep their books. We have never distinguished as such between operation and maintenance. For purposes of this case, we made a good faith estimate of what our maintenance costs would be, because we haven't had depreciation or interest charges for decades since this project was built in the 20s. The original construction cost has long since been paid off. However, this regulating district is operating under an organic statute which required it, even before it started construction of this reservoir, to have in place an apportionment and assessment scheme that guaranteed it could recover all of its costs of construction, financing, land acquisition, and ongoing maintenance and operation of the project. It's still operating under that same law today, although there was a consolidation with another regulating district along the way, which is immaterial for purposes of this case. Anyway, if this court accepts Albany Engineering's premise that Section 10F occupies the entire field of financing an upstream reservoir when there are downstream hydroelectric beneficiaries, at least insofar as those beneficiaries are concerned, that's going to leave a lot of people in the Hudson River Basin in deep kimchi, Your Honors. The regulating district has no taxing authority. It receives no appropriations from the state legislature. The only way we can recover that money is from somebody other than to whom we're assessing it now.
On your initial point, were you saying that there's a principal distinction between this case and a state law that would apply to private entities, or just that we shouldn't concern ourselves too much about it because it's just factually unlikely?
I think that both, Your Honor. I'm not aware of any law that currently exists, and I can't imagine a state legislature seizing upon the decision in this case to find a way to cross-subsidize the way states do with lotteries and school systems and things like that. But, it could happen. Congress could address it if it happened. It's not a problem right now, like I said.
It did happen, though. You said yes, that there's a – I think you said both. There's a principal distinction. What is the principal distinction between a result in the commission's favor in this case and that case?
Well, I suppose the commission could revisit its interpretation of Section 10F, but if you look at Section 10F, all it does is require three things. It requires the commission to include a license article in each license issued where there may be currently or in the future an upstream reservoir that requires it to pay headwater benefits if they're benefited by the flows from the upstream reservoir. Second, it requires the commission to determine the equitable portion of interest, depreciation, and maintenance charges that shall be paid. And third, it requires both the upstream and downstream reservoir owners to share in the cost of any investigations. It doesn't prohibit anybody from doing anything. The district, has to recover about $4.5 million a year from its downstream beneficiaries, and 95% of that is currently assessed to owners of parcels of land that have head, a difference in elevation between the beginning and the end of the parcel. If we were to no longer be able to have that source of funding, I'm not sure what we could do. We cannot just snap our fingers and reapportion costs to flood control beneficiaries. And if you look at federal dams, which are really the typical case in a FERC headwater benefit investigation, you either have Corps of Engineer dams, Bureau of Reclamation dams, or private power company dams that have been built. All of those dams were built with independent financing, and these headwater benefits are just incidental cost defrayments. They're not the entire way to finance the project. So we can't just snap our fingers and suddenly say, as this report that the Albany Engineering has tried to insert into evidence here, that one town down on the Hudson River should pay $50 million a year in flood control benefits simply because it's got a power plant that might get inundated if our project wasn't saving it from floods. Flood control benefits are extremely hard to value. Reapportionments are very complex, politically charged operations that take years, as does a FERC headwaters benefits investigation. I see my time has long since expired. I would just say in closing, Your Honors, that we do believe we would have preferred not to have a license in 2002. We would have preferred not to have any preemption in 2006, but we can live with the FERC's decision. We think they did an admirable job of respecting the plenary nature of their jurisdiction over the regulatory aspects of hydroelectric licensing without interfering with a state scheme that has worked without complaint until recently to fund a very valuable storage reservoir, which provides many benefits in the Hudson River Basin of New York. Thank you.
Mr. Wong?
Thank you. I'd like to respond to just a few of the points. First, on the question of the impact or potential impact on future headwater benefits charge systems created by other states, FERC's preemption decision is an on or off switch. And with respect to anything other than interest depreciation and maintenance costs, FERC has ruled that the switch is off, that it simply has no jurisdiction over that. There is nothing that stops other states from adopting new state-based headwater benefits systems that cover anything so long as they say that it doesn't include interest, maintenance, and depreciation costs. At the moment, to our knowledge, the New York regulating districts system is unique, that it does. It is the only entity that we know of that continues to charge headwater benefits charges without first going through the procedures that are required under Section 10F of the Federal Power Act. The district mentioned the state of Wisconsin, but one thing that has to be remembered about the state of Wisconsin is that although they established a headwater benefits system under their own state law before the Federal Power Act was even put in place, they have brought their state-based headwater benefits charges under the federal umbrella by going to FERC with a comprehensive settlement and getting FERC to approve that settlement. Actually, it was the Federal Power Commission before FERC. At the time that the FPC approved that settlement, they actually resolved all or any potential disputes regarding the charges that Wisconsin had imposed retroactively all the way back to 1920, which is what FERC said it had the power to do in terms of assessing headwater benefits charges under federal law. So Wisconsin, which had a system in place and used it for many years, brought its system within federal law and into compliance with federal law. The district, in contrast, hasn't
repeat,
done so.
I want to make sure I understand what you're saying, that FERC issued an order, which essentially, although I guess based on a settlement, but nonetheless an order retroactively straightening out headwater benefits charges back to 1920?
Yes, that's correct.
Is that cited in your brief? It didn't click with me.
I believe it. We mentioned it in our brief. I don't have it with me. I believe it's on the initial brief, page 38 and 37. It appears on 38. In that case...
Oh, this is Chippewa and Flambeau Improvement.
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
There were actually efforts to amend the Federal Power Act to allow systems like the state of Wisconsin system to continue to exist. When those efforts to amend the Federal Power Act failed, Wisconsin entities actually entered into comprehensive settlements with everybody on the affected riverways, and those settlements were filed with FERC. And I'm sorry, my time is up. Thank you very much.